This is John Beebe, January 8th, 1999, The Future of Depth Psychology, Tape 1 of 2.
San Francisco. I've known John as a lecturer from the early 80s when I first began to come to Jung Society events. And during this time, I have come to view him as one of the keenest avant-garde Jungian thinkers. John's lectures have always been dynamic, both because of the passion he has for his subject and because he presents subject matter that is on the cutting edge. During our short conversation prior to Christmas, I learned that John spent part of his childhood in China and that during the holiday he was returning to China to be the first, to be a keynote speaker in the first international Jungian conference in China, and he can tell you more about that. I also learned during this conversation that John, from my point of view, lives a little bit on the edge. He shared that he had made reservations to arrive on United today at 5:33 p.m. My heart leapt and sank in the same moment, and I was thrown into one of my high anxiety states, which I shared with him. He very graciously said he would change his plans. And in the few moments we had to decide, I was processing the risk of his not arriving on time, whether I could tolerate the tension, and whether I wanted to impose the limitations of my angst on John. I decided to let him take me into a new dimension. And I'm thankful to the gods, United Airlines, my husband, and him that he is here. John, I think I thank you for opening this new way to me, and I look forward to you taking us this evening even more to new dimensions in your lecture. Please join me in welcoming John Beebe.
I wanted to arrive at this topic at the very last possible minute because it's a problem of prediction and prophecy that I've walked into as soon as Peter Elting invited me and said that this time we were going to have to talk about the millennium. I thought, oh no, I'm not a prophet. My extroverted intuition does not usually work in the way of knowing what the great trends in the future are. I think that's an introverted intuitive skill. I think C.G. Jung really did have that capacity to sort of sniff the wind in some kind of extraordinary way and know. I mean, how did he know when he wrote the dogma of the Assumption of Mary was the single most important thing that had happened in religion in 2,000 years, and took out of all the other things that were happening in the world in 1950, that to underline in his writings as the great event. That was the year everyone was worrying about the hydrogen bomb. The Korean War had started. Where was C.G. Jung? And from our point of view, out to lunch if we were in the collective at that time. And yet, Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi from California remembers reading that statement when she was in college, and just that statement made her feel, as a Catholic woman from a political family, that something new had happened and gave her the energy and the libido not just to be the cheerleader, but to actually be one of the players in politics. The seed was planted back then. She told me that once at a meeting we had, that she graciously attended. So that ability, I wish I could give you. I don't have that ability. That's a rare gift. So at first I thought I should just not come this time. I'd come next year when it was just an ordinary year, when it wasn't a shift of so many things, when it was already into the new thing. But that wasn't when you called to ask me to come after such a period of time. This was the invitation. So I thought, well, I don't have a millennial intuition, that's for sure. Most of us don't. I actually bought a book called The Last Millennium, which you can find. And it's all about what life was like in 1000 A.D. And the author is a New York Times editor, and he put together a series of chapters about the leading figures of 1000 A.D. There wasn't a single name I recognized or that I think you would recognize, which is sort of interesting. It's sort of nice to know that in 1,000 years no one will know who Trent Lott is. It's sort of wonderful. But in any case, I don't have the... So I knew that I couldn't do a millennial lecture, but the century is turning. And centuries do mean something. The 19th century isn't the 18th century, and the 17th century surely isn't the 16th century. And the unconscious seems to know something about centuries. I'm not positive that millennia are real things in the unconscious. I think years are, and I think centuries are. I don't know about millennia. That is to say, I haven't had a dream in which it was clear that the millennium meant something. But I once had a dream I was in a situation in the Jung Institute of San Francisco where suddenly everything was changing. None of us understood why it was changing, but everyone was unhappy all at once. The staff was unhappy, the analysts were unhappy, the candidates were unhappy. And then I dreamed that the 16th century had ended and the 17th century had begun. And that was the unconscious's way of explaining it. And I've been working on that dream ever since, trying to understand the process of our institute. But it has many meanings. And if you know English history, that was when Elizabeth's reign ended, and that's when James came in. And everything changed in the 17th century, just in that one country. And, of course, many, many things changed. So that helped me. And so that tells me that centuries are real things, because I had that dream. So I thought, well, the turn of the century. And then I realized what everyone else realizes, that it's just 100 years since, at the turn of the century, since C.G. Jung read The Interpretation of Dreams in the Journal Club of the Burgholzli as, in effect, maybe a chief psychiatric resident, if that, when he was early in his training, just having finished his medical studies, and thought this was an interesting book and gave the book report, which still exists because Jung never threw anything away. And so we can read the book report on the interpretation of dreams. So that started the movement that brings me to talk to you tonight. So 100 years of development have occurred, and our psychology has come to a certain point. So it seemed appropriate to me to try to fashion as best I could what I've been calling to myself a century lecture. And that's what I'm going to try to deliver for you tonight with some trepidation and with just a bit of hoarseness, because I have just returned from China. And China was a very moving experience indeed. And one breathes a different atmosphere there in every possible way. And the Chinese people are wonderful. The Chinese ambience is variable because pollution is one of their great problems. So I found myself in one Chinese city where I actually could feel the particles going into my lungs and could see them as well. And sure enough, I came down not long after with a rather violent reaction to it all, a flu and other things, but I've been dreaming of being in dusty Chinese cities And so one pays a heavy price for travel sometimes and risking opening oneself up to other things. But it was still an extraordinary trip and worth the price. But you'll hear a little bit of it in my voice. I think I have a piece of paper here, but if I don't have it, it doesn't matter because I know it essentially by heart. I had thought that I had left a little piece of paper right on the podium, but I don't think that's probably the case. It has to do with something I found out after I decided what I wanted to talk about. And it has to do with the ways of a Confucian gentleman. And that's the piece of paper that I rather carefully put down here with my good intuition, and now have managed to somehow mislocate. Two come to me, and the third will take a minute. The first way of the Confucian gentleman is the way of goodness, and the third way of the Confucian gentleman is the way of courage. And now the second does come to me. The second is the way of wisdom. So the point of Confucianism, and one finds it in the commentaries that Richard Wilhelm created for the text of the I Ching in the Wilhelm Baines edition of the I Ching. And if you want to have an introduction to Confucian's thought, simply use the I Ching. And when you get an answer, read not only the translation of the Chinese, but Wilhelm's extraordinary commentary, and the whole spirit of Confucian philosophy will come through. And the whole point of Confucian philosophy is to find a way of living and behaving so that one's way of life has a chance of enduring. And I would like to apply that to our theme tonight. We have to ask, what is going to give this psychology that we all love any chance of enduring, that is, being relevant, being important? What will give it a continuing life beyond the enormous success that it's had at a certain point in our history? And I think we should be thinking about that, because if we don't think about that, then our field rather quickly becomes a dinosaur. So we have to think about the goodness, we have to think about the wisdom, and we have to think about the courage of the field. And so I've been thinking about how we might do that. Now, actually, I came to the Confucian three attributes of the gentleman's way of life only after I had decided on the three themes that I wanted to talk to you about tonight. And I saw immediately that they related. So I want to tell you the three themes that I am going to emphasize. And I'm going to try to illustrate them and see if you can follow where my mind is going. I'm going to build a lot on what you already know and presume on what you already know. I'm not going to simply reteach you Jungian psychology. I'm trying to say what the second century might be like, or what we might do with it in the second century. And the only way I could decide is to try to see what I find myself most worried about, wanting more written about, wanting myself to push and develop more. What are the things that I find are most interesting right now to me when I talk about Jungian psychology, when I work with Jungian analytic patients, when I talk to my colleagues, what turns me on when I open the Jungian journals, where am I? So I spent quite a lot of time figuring it, looking at what I've been talking about, what I've been thinking about. And so that's where this comes from. So it's one man's view of what the things might be. And these are the things that I plan to start the new century dealing with. And these are the questions that are open and burning for me. These are not I don't have answers to them. I have work in progress on each of them. And I'm going to try to get you to join me in that work. I'm going to try to inspire you a little bit to take up some of these issues yourself. So the first issue is one that won't, I think, surprise you coming from me. It's working on character. I think that if goodness is important, then we can't afford to be agnostic about whether analysis is turning out better people or not. Obviously, analysis cannot simply be equated with moral improvement achieved through education in right thinking. Even if we hadn't had Jung, we had Freud to describe the superego. And I think we all know that riding the superego is finally not psychological, so that I would be horrified if analysis degenerated into moral persuasion. Jung, after all, said it when he said, one does not become conscious by imagining figures of light, but rather by making the darkness conscious, that extremely famous sentence that you can find in the book Alchemical Studies in the essay The Alchemical Tree. And it was really the place in which he parted company with theosophy, with which he's often wrongly compared. And so I'm not simply talking about turning psychotherapy into a place where Dr. Laura Schlesinger would be entirely at home. I don't think that's the point. But on the other hand, we cannot be indifferent to the character issue that surfaces sooner or later in the course of any deep-seated analysis. That is to say, we all have what Michael Balint called a basic fault, an area of ourselves that's extremely problematic. And different words could be used for that area, but it's the character disorder that we all have. And it seems to me that it is possible sometimes to spend a rather long time in psychotherapy without entirely joining that issue. And one of the questions that we have to ask is how that issue might be joined. Now, just as bad as not joining the issue and hiding it is another thing that I see, which is close on to riding the superego, but it's sort of a Jungian version of it. It's a kind of extreme watchful hypervigilance with which one constantly monitors the latest movement of that complex in oneself, which one knows can be trouble, so that one is constantly scanning the dream, holding oneself, and there's a kind of a Jungian body language of someone who reaches that point in their analysis where they just sort of walk around in an extremely, extremely tight way, very guarded, lest any shadow go unlived. And somehow, I know Jung hated that that whole attitude. When I was in training, Bill Alex would tell a story about the Mary Foote, who wrote many of the notes to that we now have of the seminars. She took copious notes, and someone one day, it was Bill, was coming to his analytic hour with Jung, and Mary Foote was leaving, and he said, oh Mary, we're going sailing on the Lake of Zurich on Saturday, would you like to come? And she said, oh, well, I'll have to see what my dreams say. And he went into his session with Jung and said, you know, I was just talking to Mary Foote, and she said the oddest thing. I invited her to go sailing, and she said she'd have to see what her dreams said. And Jung said, if I asked you to go sailing, what would you say? I guess if I could, no, if I couldn't. And Jung said, exactly, you're fit for life. And that was about something nice. Now, the problem comes when people become aware of something nasty in themselves, and then I think there are a lot of Mary Foots around that are just terribly frightened and constantly monitoring. So I don't think I mean that either. What I hope analysis could be doing is creating a place where the shadow is met as fully as possible and as comfortably as possible, so that it's genuinely held and known, not glossed over, but somehow held. It's another attitude than being controlled and judged and monitored and kept in a prison or on a tight leash. And I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about what that might look like, and I'd like to show you a clip from a film, because the way I know that something is in the psyche is it shows up in a movie and it grabs me. That the movie process, the American movie process, and I'm going to show you clips from American movies. This is our dreaming process, if you like, or perhaps more precisely, our active imagination process. And when something comes that grips me and speaks to me in a particular way that just sort of has a rightness to it, I meditate about it. I say, why did that move me? And sometimes it's the image of a psychological process that we need, an image of something that we need. Well, I'm not alone in being gripped by this, but I thought I'd show you this piece. Bye. I see an awful lot of films, as many of you may know, and that, for me, is the single most archetypal moment in American movies in the last 20 years. And it's such an entirely satisfying sequence. Everything about it is perfect. It feels just so, and that's how I know it's an archetype. Because everything fits. It just absolutely all accords. It's a little miracle. And Marina Warner, I think, agrees with me in her book From the Beast to the Blonde, in which she goes through the entire history of the story of Beauty and the Beast, and she thinks the Disney movie is a definite moment in the evolution of the myth. So, but that particular moment is sublime, and like so many things, it immediately has entered our culture, so that particular image is known to just about every four-year-old girl in America. Each new four-year-old girl somehow knows that. So we have to ask ourselves, when we see something like that, it's charming, it's amusing. But when one considers it, it's extraordinarily strange. And yet this is the one the children want. You know, all the children, and this was true of the Cocteau film too, really dislike that moment at the end, as I think all of you did, when the Beast turns into another Disney prince. And it was no better when he turned into Cocteau's young man either. I mean, the children don't want Beauty and the Prince, they want Beauty and the Beast. And the children are right, because Beauty and the Beast is the archetype. That's the coincidentia oppositorum. That's the coincidence of opposites. And so I think there are probably as many meanings that could be assigned to that as their analysts. But it comes at a particular time in our development as a culture that this film is made and that this image appears. And I found myself wondering more and more about who Belle really is and who Beast really is. And I have my own view of the matter. Belle's whole story is about individuation. She really wants to get out of that provincial village. She does not want to marry the local hero Gaston. She has no intention of ending up in the film Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. She does not want to give Gaston seven sons, etc. Her entire movement is away. The courageous individual journey into the forest. So she is the post-heroic individuation heroine. And the teapot is the figure that presides over the story, and tea is served at 4 in the afternoon. So we're dealing here with a midlife story, whatever the children find in it. We're dealing here with something that belongs to the individuation sector and the Jungian proper sense of that time when, as Eric Erickson says, the theme that comes up for us is integrity. And as you know, I wrote a book about integrity, and as I first began to work with the material, I was very upset that I couldn't find an image of integrity. I thought, if I'm really writing about something that we can feel, where is the image of, and I was quite disturbed by that for some time. And so I did various forms of hocus pocus when I wrote my book to kind of create historical images, but all the time I felt like I don't have a simple everyday image. And it wasn't until I got invited to speak in Southern California, in Anaheim, I think, to the friends of Jung there, and I thought, what's there? And I thought, Disneyland. What's Disneyland? And Snow White occurred to me. Snow White. And suddenly I got the idea that Snow White might be about integrity. And I began to look at the fairy tale. And the more I looked at it, the more I saw imagery that began to locate. And I got interested in the image of beauty itself as a glyph for integritas. So as I had done, I've mentioned her already, but as I had done when I was working on the book, I wrote again or spoke again to Marina Warner, and she said, oh yes, integritas was always, beauty in Aquinas and in the Middle Ages was always a sign of integritas. In other words, the wholeness of form. So it seemed to me that the commonest image actually is something beautiful and whole. And it seems to me that that image of beauty in this particular fairy tale is the image of the integrity that comes sometimes in the midst of the psychological project on the individuation journey. I believe that what individuates in us is not the whole of our personality, but I believe that our integrity does individuate, and that's what that stone at the end is. That philosopher's stone is the individuated integrity. It's that thing which can be perfect, that incorruptibility in the unconscious which we can develop, we use that to deal with everything else in us that doesn't change, you see. Because there's a whole lot about us that obviously does not transform. And anyone who reads the Jungian project, that the whole personality is going to get in the alchemical bath and you're just going to come out a marvelous, it's going to be individuated stone. You're going to be very unhappy because you're going to find that same character disorder at the end of the journey that you started with. And that has led some in our field, James Hillman notably, to become very cynical about what psychotherapy can do generally. But if you take the Beauty and the Beast model and get out of heroic thinking, if you get out of the Gaston psychology, which Hillman taught us to do, and we get out of the idea that this is all about mastering anything, then you can move to another model. And it seems to me that the dance of Beauty and the Beast is a kind of marvelous allegory. And I think allegory sometimes is underrated. And I see it as the allegory of the dance of integrity with character. In other words, character is the problem for all of us. Integrity is the thing we can develop to hold the problem of character. And holding it is what they do. They hold each other. They dance together. The beast, the problematic character, the figure that is, as Joe Henderson says, is kind and cruel at the same time, which is so typical of that part of ourselves. I call it sometimes the demonic daimonic, with a slash. It's this extraordinary ambivalent part of ourselves, the part that is both destroyer and healer at the same time. That problematic thing is well held by a developed integrity. So it seems to me that we should be learning in our work in psychotherapy to foster beauty's task, to foster beauty's development so that beauty can do the job and understand what that looks like, which is absolutely not imprisoning beast or engaging in this kind of psychological checkmate, but something else. It's a different model. And it seems to me that the image is there. And to the little degree that I've been experimenting and working with what that would be like for a number of people with rather severely difficult characters, I'm absolutely convinced that the analytic process is a place where one can quite develop the capacity to relate to the beast with that beauty attitude. I think it can be done. And I think then I think the risk of antisocial acting out is actually less than in any other kind of therapy that I've seen. There's one has to create a space where that which is most shameful is joyously held. It's a paradox, but I wanted to give you the image. And as I say, I'm giving you ideas on the edge. You have to sort of try to fill in the blanks. When I saw this image, I finally realized what our integrity is for. I kind of wondered what our integrity really is for. And it seems to me that's... that's psychologically what it's for, as far as I'm concerned. Now, in fleshing out this image, I've found the tool that I've used over the years, psychological types, extraordinarily helpful. Looking at this film closely over a long period of time, I've become aware of the typological structure of the film as a whole. And I mentioned the hero figure, Gaston, who has an idea that Belle is going to marry him, and that he's pushing this idea. And he, when he can't get her fair and square, he actually goes so far as to hire a psychiatrist to label and her father as insane and put him in a mental hospital. So this is a man who has to have things according to his ideas, and if that doesn't work, then his ideas then take on a sinister, a pathologically labeling quality. And I think that's a pretty good image of heroic, extroverted thinking gone wrong. And I think it's an image of that function in our own culture. I think Belle, who is very much her own person, extremely self-possessed, and usually prefers reading, has a very contained, ladylike quality, and the reading that she most likes to do is to read stories of romantic love and histories, is a marvelous image of introverted feeling. So that we are looking, it seems to me, in this particular film, at an introverted feeling function that's very much in the soul anima place, perhaps. That leaves the question of Beast's type. It seems that Beast, who is extremely clumsy, but very concerned with validation and relationship and how he's seen, and has a terrible time of it, but is in the archetypal position of the host, is a rather marvelous image of a demonic extroverted feeling. So that we have an interesting discovery there, that the soul figure carrying the inferior function, as in classical Jungian psychology, Bell, is encountering her typological opposite, in the sense that her use of feeling is introverted and Beast's use of feeling is extroverted, so that we can rather precisely define the relationship between them in this movie in terms of a place in the psyche becomes a relationship between two complexes very far down from consciousness. An event taking place very deep in the psyche indeed. Now, this kind of care in locating where significant emotional events occur may be part of what happens in the next century of depth psychology, that we've opened ourselves up in the first century to the fact that there are these complexes and that they exist. Now we're going to start learning about the ways they relate to each other. And this is just one that I've worked on a lot. The way the inferior function that we've read so much about relates to its own shadow, so that we not only have a fourth function that we have to worry about, but an eighth function that the fourth function is worrying about. And we're going to, and I, as I go deeper and deeper into the structure of our character, I see these interactions all the time, and we see them in dreams all the time. Dreams are populated with inner figures that we don't even know who are having very intense relationships with each other. And we're going to have to learn much more about what those relationships are, what they mean. We're going to have to take them seriously. And so we will be probably looking rather closely at some of these processes. And I think that's all right. I think we're ready for that. I think the psyche is real enough that we can begin to look at some of these things in a very particular way. I can only tell you that every time I do this kind of work, something opens up inside of me. It takes a very practical form. I mean, in my own Jungian analysis, there was a point at which I had a dream in which I met a Chinese woman who was sitting alone in a room, and she didn't have anything. It was very bare, and she was very, very unhappy. She was unhappy because her husband was out spending his money. Your function, which might be compared to that husband out squandering the libido on all the interests that I had, there was this introverted sensation woman, because my association gave her that typology, who didn't have anything. And that meant that there was a part of myself which had not been given energy. And that was the classical anima, not in any way like the anima figure I imagined I would meet, but that one that one wouldn't necessarily want to be seen with in public, and that one that was absolutely personal to my psychology and my typology. And it represented the pitiful neglect I was giving to what my own body was doing and where it was and how it felt about things. And as I began to give that energy, a whole world opened up for me that I would not have been not expected to have happened. And something must have happened, because she came again and she was feeling better now. Her husband was taking her out for ice cream. I was giving energy, and it was very practical. I was learning to do things like breathe when you listen to a patient telling you a dream with fascinating archetypal content, so you don't get CO2 narcosis and a headache. And notice the feelings in your body when you do therapy, not just what can happen with your head having read von Franz's seminar, you know, and all that kind of thing. And it changed the way I worked and so forth. And it was at that point of discovering the other within that I think my own integrity as a therapist happened. So for me, the bell image was really that woman, you see, that I could, that the process of finding that woman inside and doing something that would actually support her. Now, it never occurred to me in my young life that once she was given a chance at life, she could then in turn help me with that even deeper shadow I have around extroverted sensation. But I have found that she can. You see, she can hold that problem. In other words, when one develops a certain part of oneself, that part then is available to do work for you psychologically. And it has a whole story. And it seems to me we're going to learn this. Those of us who've been on the journey, and the culture's been on the psychological journey, we've developed psychological organs in 100 years. Now we're going to find out what they're for. See, the story Jung gave us is that, yes, Virginia, there's a psyche. But now we've got to figure out what it's for. I mean, there's some reason why we've all gotten interested in psychology. I mean, we've all vaguely known we need it to save the planet and so forth. But I think we're going to learn a lot more about, and it's going to be very exciting. So don't leave now. I mean, it's a very exciting time ahead. And I think that beauty is to take care of beast was what I learned from this movie. And I've been applying that to some of my own inner work, and I find that it does work. It is actually true. The next thing that I think the future is going to ask of us, and hopefully offer to us, the place that I think our field has to go if it's going to grow, is that we must become engaged in understanding culture. Um, we're going to have to develop an effective cultural analysis. Here, the beast is C.G. Jung. He's been both kind and cruel to us in this regard, because in one sense, he opened the door in so many ways to the analysis of culture. And yet, his specific opinions, his specific offered opinions on so many cultures are so problematic, if not offensive in some cases, that he really has been kind and cruel at the same time. And so much of Jungian cultural analysis is not even as good as some of the things one reads in op-ed pages, and it, so much of it has a kind of op-ed globalizing process. I think we're going to have to look very closely at culture complexes and the pattern of complexes as they appear in cultures. And Andrew Samuels has written a whole book called The Political Psyche on just this theme of how this might be done. And what's important is that he devoted quite a lot of time to thinking about how we ought to think about the culture that is having its neurosis while we have our particular neuroses. So each of us has to develop his or her own way of getting at the cultural problem, starting with our own culture, it seems to me. I would prefer that each of us make an effort to find out about our own culture. And here you can really separate the sheep from the goats. I am invited frequently to lecture and show a movie. And I always try to show a movie that shows something of the shadow of American culture, because I think that's something that a Jungian group... And I haven't exactly been ridden out of town on a rail, but I've actually been disinvited a couple of times for... wanting to show either Blue Velvet or Pulp Fiction, because they felt that it just wouldn't be good for their membership, and they just weren't willing to look at it and really engage with these rather serious documents that go right to the core of some of the big hot culture complexes in our particular. So when I have shown these films, and then I show what it means to really look at them analytically, people usually are very pleased with what they're finally able to see. And the important thing, I think, is to do the work. I don't think that my method is the only way, but I have worked out a method. I think each and every one of you should be working out a method of reading the cultures around you, starting with your own, and then see where that goes. So I thought I'd give you a sample of a clip that spoke to me about a process in our culture, and just give you a sense of what I do with it, because I think this is a kind of analysis that you're going to see a lot of in the next years. In other words, I can't be the only one that's looking at things and trying to make sense of them. People are doing it all. That's why I gave you The Soul of Popular Culture, for instance, to look at on your reading list when you asked for one. But there's a sequence from a film that not all of you will have seen, as you perhaps all have seen Beauty and the Beast. I imagine a number of you saw The Grifters a few years ago when it came out. It had Angelica Houston. It's maybe the one she won the Academy Award for. It's a fabulous movie by Stephen Frears that is about con artists, going by the, hence the name grifters, and it draws on the pulp writing of a kind of mythic American writer, Jim Thompson, and the great movie-making abilities of Stephen Frears and the cast, which consists of John Cusack and Annette Bening, as well as Angelica Houston. And there's a little sequence of interaction between the John Cusack character and the Annette Bening character, which seems to me to be ripe for analysis. And again, it's one of those sequences. It's quite a bit longer than what you just saw, but it's one of those sequences that, taken as a whole, gripped me, and I said, yes, this is what it has been like to live in this country in the last few years. I recognize this. And then I began to work on it. And that's what I'm asking you all to do. When something moves you like that, then really bring everything you've got to the understanding of it. So take a look at this and see if it moves you too. Well, that's a long clip, and I deliberately wanted you to have one piece. I will say that I cannot imagine practicing Jungian analysis in this country without understanding this sequence. I'm going to say what I got out of it so that you'll see what I mean. The entire sequence is framed as a seduction of one character by the other. And as in so many fairy tales, the story that's told is meant to seduce, as in Kiss of the Spider Woman or many other Scheherazade, whatever, many. Now, the meaning of the scene, it seems to me, turns on our understanding of who is being seduced by whom. So, the John Cusack character, Roy, is a very strong image, as film images involving very good actors in the hands of very good directors can sometimes be extremely clear images of a particular consciousness. And if you notice the extreme precision of his movements, the tidiness with which he had the money that he was putting in the box, the care with which he put the magnets under his sleeve that held the loaded dice, the face that hardly moves. Cusack has one of the great unmoving faces. He's one of the most expressive actors with hardly any motion at all. If you know psychological type, this is about as clear an image of introverted sensation as you'd ever want to get. Von Franz says, if you look at the axis of the eyeball of the introverted sensation type, you'll find that it doesn't move when it looks at things because it's a waste of energy. And introverted sensation concerns itself with energy efficiency. So it would be perfect that he would be involved in the short con because he could control it and it would all be very small bits of money that he could build up over a period of time and store and so forth. Now, this is surely Annette Bening's best performance, and she's just as striking an image as he is, and perhaps it all comes to that extremely satiny, tight dress that she wears so that she slinks in as she's checked out and signaled the action in the room before she goes on to more trouble in another room. And it seems to me that with all of the extensive ways that she uses her abundantly expressive face and body, is just as strong an image of extroverted sensation as he is of introverted sensation. So we're watching a very interesting psychological process in which extroverted sensation is actively seducing introverted sensation. We're looking at a rare example, it seems to me, of a power shift away from one way of using a function to another way of using a function. When we're looking at the evolution of cultures and making a culture analysis, it's that kind of process that I think we should be extremely carefully looking at. In the American psyche, I think this has been a critical shift that has occurred sometime since World War II, but in a very escalated way since the beginning of the 1980s. Now, I don't think any of you failed in the flashback scene to the great con artist Cole Langley to see that extraordinary set piece that's so entertaining as the perfect send-up of the 80s. There was the leveraged buyouts. There we saw in a wonderful graphic way what our culture went through during those very important years when the big hustle really, the big con really occurred. The big, and I think you all tuned into that. I think it's quite obvious and quite entertainingly done. And quite now, what I find interesting in that sequence is the interplay between the Cole Langley figures, played by the great character actor J.T. Walsh, who just died, and Annette Bening. The way we see their interaction. And did you notice how archetypal Langley's imagery is? When he took those, when he talked about the 7-second delay, and he was holding those spheres and manipulating them, and the way he talked had, I spent a lot of time looking at a lot of American movies, and I've tracked the characters who speak in archetypal ways. And often they invoke imagery. There's a character like that in Dances with Wolves. Many of you may remember the moment when the man has to get his Dunbar has to get his commission to be able to go out into the interior at all. And he has to go through a very strange major who's at the station who speaks he says, "Well, I will grant your boon, Sir Knight." And then he behaves in a very peculiar way and finally gives him the order all scrunched up. And as Dunbar is leaving, a shot is heard, and the man has committed suicide. His last words are, "The king is dead. Long live the king." Now, the psychological function that casts things in archetypal ways and is all image and no reality. The room with the computers is completely empty, a chaos. This is a very good image of introverted intuition, in this case, and in the case of Dances with Wolves, in a shadowy trickster position. And the introverted intuitive trickster and the extroverted sensation witch make a wonderful team together, in the way they work together to seize power. Now, it goes sour for the introverted intuitive at the end, and he's saying it's all hollow, almost as if he's quoting Eliot, "The Hollow Men." And he ends up in a Tascadero, in other words, the place for the criminally insane. Now, so we have an interesting process. We have the extroverted sensation woman remaining, making a massive effort to pull this puerile introverted sensation man over into the long con. And the seduction is the story of how well this introverted intuitive trickster did it, until unfortunately he went insane, but then that was just over and we can start a new cycle. Now, I think that's a little typological story about something that's been happening in our own particular culture over the past 25 years that we ought to take quite a look at. As I understand the typology of the American collective, if we were to invoke the idea of good type development, this is an extroverted thinking country. It's supposed to be about observing the rule of law, and it's supposed to operate on principle and constitution and so forth. And it works reasonably well when it has a good auxiliary introverted sensation that's taking care of business, husbanding the resources, restoring the quality of the environment, so forth. But in recent years, another complex has come up so strongly that we have actually been using it as if it were our auxiliary, and that is extroverted sensation. And it's come up out of the shadow, out of the place of the cynic and witch, and out of greed. And we now have the problem that we are using an extroverted thinking and an extroverted sensation. Then our third function, our puer extroverted intuitive function, is there. So it moves the country into a pathologically extroverted place because we don't have the normal checks and balances that healthy type development gives. The MBTI movement has taught us, and now Jungian analysts increasingly take this, though they were the last to get it, that if one has a superior extroverted function, it's immediately compensated for by an auxiliary introverted function, if the psyche is working as it should, so that we have this nice balance between the extroverted and the introverted. We've lost that in this country, so that we have this pathological extroversion. And the effect is that the country is hypomanic. You feel it any time you leave the country. You feel like you're being dialyzed. You just have to go to Switzerland or Canada is quite good enough. But the difference between being on the San Juan Island that belongs to Canada and has the other name and the San Juan Island, Friday Harbor, it's just, I mean, Friday Harbor, it's like coming into Grand Central Station by comparison to the quietness that is just taken for granted. And as you all know this, because you probably go up there whenever you need to kind of... And you're in one of the peaceful parts of the country. So I don't see how we could possibly understand the dilemma of an American in Alisand without understanding this particular cultural background. Now, that the introverted sensation type in the film is no longer a father, but a seducible pueriternus, because I expect the auxiliary function to be operating in a mature and fatherly way in a well-run patriarchal culture, but it isn't, is quite disturbing. And the fact that... The introverted intuitive is putting in all of the capacity to envision into the designing of a scam, begins to say, that's saying that that function, which should be providing the religious vision, is actually serving the greed trip with all of its archetypal energy, and rapidly running itself aground in a crisis of meaninglessness, you see, the hollowness. It seems to me this is a very disturbing situation, and if this, in fact, is what's been happening to the country, then the country has a serious imbalance. There's something seriously off. And so people like me go to the movies and watch very, very closely to see what's happening with the introverted intuitive trickster. Where has it gone? Where has that energy gone? That's why I got so excited about Pulp Fiction that the Jungian group wouldn't even let me show in one case, because in that film there's a change in the introverted intuitive character. The one who speaks in archetypal imagery and sees and uses the religious rhetoric is the Samuel Jackson character, Jules. And he starts as a hitman just working for the drug lord. But when the synchronistic event occurs, he sees the writing on the wall of the bullet holes that miss him. The great moment in the film is that someone comes out of the back room and unloads his pistol on these men who are holding up this group of amateur drug runners. And not one of the bullets hits the two hitmen. And for one of them, the Travolta character, Vincent, it's no big deal. For the other one, it's a religious event. And he realizes that he's been saved and saved for a reason and that he has to change his life. And in the last scene of the film, he makes an enormous shift in which he makes a connection, a strong connection to a guardian spirit, and moves entirely away from... violence. So that made me feel like, for the first moment, because I kept seeing psychotic trickster with no redeeming Every time an introverted intuitive character came up, it was a serial killer like Travis Bickle in A Taxi Driver, or the Liberty Bell murderer in Blowout, or it was just one after another of hopeless... remember, those of you who saw The Silence of the Lambs, the Buffalo Hyde murderer. The introverted intuitive character was someone who was a dead end, and suddenly there was a movement in the shadow. There was a shift. There was an opportunity, and that was in the film Pulp Fiction. So, for me, a cultural analysis is locating, identifying in whatever way one can, the complexes of the culture in which you live, and then watching what they're doing, watching where they're going, making some effort to see where they are, and letting your own culture tell its psychological story to you, and getting passionately interested in that, and seeing how the problems you're having relate to that cultural background. Seems to me that we have a lot of tools for doing this, and that we should start to use them more than we do. Now, how are we doing in time? Do we want to breathe? I think this would be a good moment to take a break, and we can. Enough of you are back. Place that I think our psychology can go, wants to go, and needs to know how to go in the right way. That means in a psychological way. I would call opening to spirit. It's as if Jungian psychology has been approaching and avoiding its spiritual responsibility for quite a long time now. And for a long time, it seemed like the last word was that paper by Hillman, Peaks and Veils, in which he said psychotherapy and spiritual discipline are two different things. And in that paper, he was working out that basically spiritual discipline is puer, and psychotherapy and psychological work is anima or soul, and the soul work is the psychological work, and the spiritual work is something else. So that, interestingly, Hillman has ended up in the same place as Jung with regard to meditation. Hillman has been saying it's obscene to meditate when there's a fire going on in the house. That is this terrible ecological emergency. And he's right, there is a fire going on. There is a terrible ecological emergency. And what happened to my lungs in China really made me see what so many people have to live with and how protected we are in the Northwest from that. But it's not that he's not wrong about the fire. But anyone who practices Jungian analysis discovers an extraordinary thing, that on a regular basis, one becomes, as the analyst, the conduit for spirit. There are moments in the analytic process where I seem to myself to be taken over by something that I don't understand, which begins to use the interpretive process in a way to make what can only be called spiritual statements, which turn out to be some of the most meaningful things the people who come to see me ever hear. And it's that they want to hear. And when it first began to happen, it frightened me quite a bit. Now I take it as part of my work, and that's only the points in the process where I'm carrying it. quite often I'm the witness while someone else's spiritual moment is taking place. And I'm amazed how little we have really worked with some of Jung's most interesting writings on this subject, because he knew quite a bit about this and had a lot to say. I already gave you the famous quote, one does not become conscious by imagining figures of light, but rather by making the darkness conscious. But very few people have thought about what it means to make the darkness conscious, what that really is, and what that process is like. And when I was asked finally to participate in a symposium on spirit, and I had to spend most of the day talking about spirit, and in terror went back and read what Jung had written about it so that I would know what I was talking about, I became aware of something that I don't think has been adequately emphasized in our field. Maybe it's just my blindness that I missed it, or maybe it's maybe others would miss it too, and it's everyone else has already known it. But I think I always thought spirit entered the psyche through the self. I think I had the idea that the self was this great, wonderful thing, that if one got the anima to function, the anima would be the bridge to the self. And that was how the theory was taught. So that you met the shadow early in the work. That was, and that was the apprentice work. And if you were honest and humble and accepted your shadow and so forth, then eventually the struggle with the shadow would give way to the discovery of the anima or the animus, the contrasexual. Things would start to get more positive. Then the animus would act as a kind of bridge, or the anima, to the self. And the self would come in with some kind of charged sense of religious vocation, and that would somehow be your vocation, and that would infuse your life with meaning and spirit. That was a beautiful theory, I've had some very poignant, incredibly healing moments where something like that has occurred, where you know a kind of a grail comes from the self. So I don't in any way dispute that there's a truth in all that, but that process does not seem to me in any way to be Jung's last word on spirit. As I read Jung going through it, and I'll just say it telegraphically, spirit comes into the psyche through the shadow. That's what he means when he says you do not become conscious by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. So, the Jungian group that won't look at Pulp Fiction is missing the point of Jungian psychology. If you can't let Jules, the black character, and the shadow character, not merely African-American, but also a killer, a hitman, and a shadow figure in the typology, because he is a dark Mercurius, he is a trickster, introvert, intuitive. If you cannot let him go through his evolution and see what takes place, you're not letting spirit come to you through the shadow of this culture. There's something is being offered there, and I wonder how many people are actually letting that process occur. So that gets back to what happens after Beauty's dance with Beast. What's the next step in the story? If character is a problem and a character needs to be held with integrity, what happens in the psyche when character is held with integrity? I don't think the particular movie, Beauty and the Beast, is the place to look for that answer. But I think we will find that when the shadow is held with integrity, it delivers spirit to us. And this is a different process from the anima or animus making a bridge to the healing self. It's a different process, because it involves what I would call, rather than self, other. And I think the word that has been largely missing in Jungian psychology is the word other. And when Joe Henderson was asked some time ago by some candidates and analysts, how do you know when someone is engaged in the individuation process? We all expected a grand answer. And he said, I'm convinced it's going on when someone's working with their shadow. So it isn't the apprentice piece at all. It's the final piece. It's the cutting edge. Our shadow has a purpose. It has something to offer us. Now, if there had been time for a film clip, I would have shown you a very interesting little piece from a movie I'm very fond of that I advise you all to rent and enjoy. It's the film 6 Degrees of Separation. And it has a stunning performance by Will Smith and an equally great performance by Stockard Channing. And it involves a story that all of you know very well because it's an anecdotal story, but a true story about a man who talked his way, an African-American street person who talked his way into a number of upper-class New York East Side homes by pretending that he was the son of Sidney Poitier and the classmate of these otherwise, I think, all Caucasian upper-class people whose children were at Harvard and Radcliffe. And when it's finally unraveled how he got the information that he had to have to pull the con off, comes this marvelous moment in the film where rather than being appalled by the person who's conned her, this sophisticated New York woman is absolutely enchanted that this man would have learned so much. And she begins to talk about him as if he were, you know, a Magellan. She says he learned all that in 6 weeks. Imagine, you know, and then she begins to muse, and she has this very famous piece where she talks about how all of us on the planet are related to other people by 6 people. So that there's 6 degrees of separation between each of us and all the other people on the planet. Now, what is so beautiful in this film is the Stockard Channing performance, but beyond that, the attitude of the character Ouiza that she portrays, because she is also another introverted intuitive who is making a change in her attitude. And what's extremely exciting is that rather than be horrified, as her husband is, by the sociopathy of the shadow figure, she's interested in the creativity, the intelligence, and the imagination. In other words, the event stimulates her moral imagination, and she begins to consider the separations that divide us all, and she gets the opposite vision, the vision of connection. And it's so she represents what I would call the attitude of